You're listening to This Week in Palestine, a program dedicated to amplifying voices from the ground and offering critical perspectives on the ongoing struggle for justice, dignity, and liberation in Palestine. Each week, we bring you stories, analysis, and commentary, not only from a Palestinian point of view, but also from a global lens, connecting the dots between local resistance and international dynamics. We explore how policies, power structures, and media narratives shape the lived realities of Palestinians and how those realities resonate with broader movements for justice around the world. Please note, the views and opinions expressed during the following hour are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect the official positions of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. Our goal is not to offer sanitized soundbites, but to challenge assumptions, spark dialogue, and deepen understanding. Thank you for joining us on this journey. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio. Sabah al khair, masa al khair, aina ma kuntum wa ahlan bikum bihadha al isbu'a fi Palestine. Ma'akum Rinad al Ghul. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be. I'm your host, Reynad Al Ghul, and I welcome you back to another episode of This Week in Palestine. Today, we return our focus to Gaza and the West Bank, where the world may be watching, but the suffering remains relentless. The headlines may shift, but the reality on the ground endures: displacement, resistance, and the daily struggle for dignity. It is Sunday, July 6th, 2025, and the question still echoes: how long must the people endure before the world moves from witness to action? Stay with us as we continue to shed light on the stories that matter. Why is the genocide still unfolding? Day after day, hour after hour, while the world watches in silence. Why have mass graves, starving children, and bombed out homes become background noise in the global conversation? Is this what we now call normal? Why are the cries of Palestinians so easily ignored, their suffering rendered invisible by media filters and political convenience? Why is it that those responsible for war crimes walk freely in suits and ties, shaking hands in diplomatic halls, while the victims are buried under rubble? When will the world say, enough is enough? How can so many sleep soundly at night, knowing that entire families are being erased, that children are growing up under siege, and that justice is being denied in real time? These are not rhetorical questions. They are a moral reckoning. Because silence is not neutrality, it is complicity. And if we allow this to continue, we are not just witnessing history, we are failing it. So ask yourself, what will it take for you to speak up? Because the time to act is not tomorrow, it's now. Let's turn now to a powerful conversation between Dr. Miriam Francois and her guest Ahmed El-Nouk as they explore a vital question: do ordinary people have the power to end the siege on Gaza? Together they unpack the role of global solidarity, public pressure, and the moral responsibility of those watching from afar. Let's listen in.
Today, we are joined by Palestinian writer and human rights activist Ahmed El-Nouk, whose new book, We Are Not Numbers, The Voices of Gaza's Youth, is already shaking up the digital conversation and reminding us that behind every statistic is a story, a family, a life. Ahmed, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
It's my absolute pleasure to have you with us, Ahmed. You've co-edited this deeply touching book, which brings together the stories of so many young people from Gaza. And I wanted to ask you about this idea that when Palestinians tell their stories, they have to self-censor, they have to filter. How much did you have to filter in telling this book, Ahmed, and why?
What a way to start the conversation, Mariam. Pam and I wrote the introduction. I wrote three stories in this book, and we also wrote the epilogue. And yeah, I'm very privileged to have done this work, because this is a work of more than 59 Palestinians, young people who have been writing their heart out to the world for the past 10 years. And these are their personal stories. So I'm very, very proud of this book. And I'm very proud to be the co-editor of this book. Well, when we talk about self-censoring, in this book, I believe that we encouraged our writers to write their stories unfiltered, completely unfiltered. Now, the problem with us Palestinians is that, as I said it before in another podcast, we Palestinians, we don't have the luxury of making a single mistake, because any single mistake you make, you're done, you're canceled forever. And we don't have the luxury to write everything that comes in our mind, even in our moments of weakness. Unfortunately, we'll have to always be vigilant.
And it's not just the threat of being cancelled, right? You dedicate...
Of course, it's not about being cancelled. I don't care about being cancelled. But for people who are like us, a Palestinian who lives in the UK, they can hurt you in many, many other ways.
Right.
And if you are a Palestinian who lives in Gaza, and if you were speaking up, you could be easily targeted and killed, like what happened to Dr. Rifat Al-Arir. He was killed for some jokes that he made on Twitter. So it's very dangerous to be a Palestinian in this world.
And I think that's what I wanted to get at with that question, was that you dedicate this book to Rifat Al-Arir, who is a poet, a professor, God rest his soul, who, as you say, was killed by Israel in this most recent phase of the genocide. And, you know, Rifat is someone whose influence is very palpable through the book. And I was hoping we could talk for a few minutes about him, about why he was such a monumental figure, and perhaps why he was even targeted.
He was targeted because he was dangerous to Israel.
Why was he dangerous, Ahmed?
Because he's smart, he's a writer, he's peaceful in some way, and he can make a huge difference. And Israel is so scared of people who can influence the world. They're very scared of people who can write, who can tell stories, who can author books, who can train the younger generation of the Palestinians who become writers and authors. Israel wanted for the past 77 years to really sideline the Palestinian stories, to silence the Palestinians and make the Palestinian stories go nowhere. And people like Rifat Al-Arir, he wasn't only telling the Palestinian stories, he wasn't only writing, but he was training the younger generations of the Palestinians to tell their stories and to share it with the world. And that is precisely why he is very dangerous to Israel.
You know, I was trying to figure out earlier on, if you were around 30 years old, how many wars or how many assaults on Gaza you would have lived on. And it's like around 7, I think, and, you know, plus...
You can't count.
No, but the major operations, yeah. But absolutely, you can't even count. And so how would you describe the impact on you and on people in Gaza of kind of living continuously with this threat? How do you live knowing that day to day, you know, a major shift can happen that can completely alters your life and those of people around you?
Well, we have a poem in this book written by Basmane Derawi, and he's one of the brightest Palestinian poems that I have the pleasure of working with. And he said, "I have a degree in wars," in one of these poems. So unfortunately, if we want to count the major wars, I don't know what is the definition of major war, but ever since I was in Gaza, ever since that second intifada started, I forgot how many incursions, how many military invasions, how many wars Israel and assaults Israel launched against the Palestinian people. And I remember one of the earliest stories that we wrote in We Are Not Number, one of our writers, and he said in one of the lines, "I grew one war older." It's like now we calculate our time based on wars and incursions and military assaults in Gaza, not on in terms of years. And yes, this is something controversial. I said before, maybe these wars and this occupation and this siege and this blockade, it affected our life in many ways in a negative way. And it made us, we Palestinians, not normally human beings compared to other people who never experienced wars. And I'm not trying to make the Palestinians look bad, but I'm...
What do you mean by that?
The way we look to the world is different from the way normal people look at the world. We are different in many, many ways. And I remember when I first came to the UK, and it always puzzled me when I am like driving in a car and then I see normal people having picnic in a park and going out and enjoying their time and having a tan under the sun. And I was like, we always feel like Are they right? Are we right? What is normal life? We don't understand what life is about. One of my friends who's a child psychiatrist, he told me that people in Gaza, they just survive. They don't live. The concept of living in Gaza is different from the concept of living outside of Gaza. Because our life in Gaza is all about like surviving this day or the following day. No one can really understand what living in Gaza is like. And especially now in the genocide. And that's why we started this project. That's why we started We Are Not Numbers. Because we often read about Gaza as in numbers, as in statistics, as headlines. But no one really understands what is really going on in Gaza. And I need to tell you some examples. Yesterday I was calling my sister. And you know, I still have two sisters who live in Gaza. And my sister told me, she was telling me what happens through her life. And she told me that recently one of her kids started to develop like some kind of skin disease because of the pollution, because of the lack of clean water. And then she took him to the hospital, and the hospital, they gave him an oral medication for this disease. And then when my sister was trying to give him this medication, she smelled the medication and it tasted sweet. So my sister told me that she tried to taste this medication. And when she tasted that medication, it turned out to be like sweet. So my sister told me that she and her four children took turns on this medication, tasting it and drinking it as if they're drinking some kind of a smoothie or good drink. And that is a medication that that was meant to be for children. This is the way that people are now living in Gaza. They're risking their life there. Maybe this is not good for her health, but she urgently craved having a sweet drink. Another day she told me that for a few months they've been craving tea. You know, we're in the tea here. They're craving and drinking tea. People in the outside, they know of Gaza. Some of them got exhausted of hearing stories of Gaza and hearing about Gaza in the news. But no one really can understand what living in Gaza is like. And I believe that people in Gaza will be very disappointed when they know that the people lost interest in Gaza. And if people don't really understand what's happening, it's really disappointing. And that's why we try to encourage people to really read about Gaza and hear the stories from the Palestinians. Because the pain that the Palestinians is going through is unimaginable. And believe it becomes more painful to the people in Gaza to know that all of the pain and the suffering that they're going through is unnoticed by the world or unfelt.
And certainly recent events have meant that a lot of what's been happening in Gaza has fallen by the sidelines of the news headlines, if it was ever there. You mentioned there that you had two remaining sisters in Gaza. Ahmed, I want to obviously start by expressing my condolences to you because you have lost 21 members of your family in Gaza. I, you know, watched a number of episodes of other shows that you'd been on where people ask you about that pain. I actually don't know what it makes sense to ask to somebody who has experienced so much pain, aside from what do you do with pain on that scale. I sat there yesterday thinking about it. I was like, I can't even wrap my head around that. I can't wrap my head around it. The pain of losing one person you love is immense. What do you do with that amount of pain?
I don't want to say that I'm used to it or this pain is numb and I don't feel it anymore, because you feel it every single day. But what can I do, Maryam? What can I do? If I want to live really my pain, I would just disappear and not talk to people, not talk to media, not work, not do anything. But we don't have that luxury, Maryam. We'll have just to keep reminding ourselves that we are living here for a purpose. That my life is not only my life. My life is the lives of the Palestinian people. And they depend on me to tell their stories and to share it with the world and advocate for their rights. So it's not up to me to really immerse myself in my pain and do what I want to do. I'm not doing what I want to do. I'm doing what I need to do for the sake of my people. And that's why I'm forcing every day in the morning to wake up. I don't want to wake up. Every day when I wake up, I don't want to wake up. I want to keep sleeping forever. I don't want to go to work. I don't want to meet people. I don't want to do anything of what I'm doing right now. But it's not up to me. So what I do with my pain, I use it as a weapon, as a vehicle to reach my goal and the goal of the Palestinians, which is liberation and freedom and justice. And this is what I'm doing with my pain right now.
For a lot of people, pain of that magnitude would turn to anger. I don't have anywhere near your connection to what's happening in Gaza, and I feel a huge amount of anger.
As you should.
I think a lot of people do. Do you feel angry, and who are you angry with?
Anyone who goes through what I am going through should feel angry, should be angry. They should be angry about with anyone and with everyone, with everything, with the world, with Israel, with the Palestinian factions, with all those who failed us, with the Arabs, with the Muslims, with the Christians, with the Jews, with everyone. We should be angry because we have been let alone. We have been disappointed by the entire world. Everyone is watching us being slaughtered every day, and no one is moving a finger to change it. And I'm angry with that. I don't like it. But I always try to not make my anger control me or make me do stuff that I shouldn't do. I use my anger, I try to use my anger in a positive way, in a way that I encourage people, I inspire people to do some action. I will not show my anger to the world that, I will not make my anger make me full of hatred, because hatred and anger are not good things. And sometimes they can be a drive for not for good, for failure. And I'm always aware of what should I do with my anger? What should I do with my pain? Or should I make it control me or not? But I do not blame those Palestinians who are very angry at everyone and who show their anger and their disappointment with anyone. They have every right to do so. I just happen to be more calm than the rest of than many of other people, actually. But it's not normal. Maybe I'm not normal.
No, and it can be its own form of trauma response, right? I'm sure you've heard that before. You mentioned there feeling abandoned, feeling like the Palestinians have been left to die without, you know, any effort from kind of wider communities. We've seen some efforts, obviously, the flotilla that tried to sail to Gaza and that was stopped by the Israelis. We saw the Great March on Gaza happening, where, you know, there were interventions from, I think, probably multiple authorities coordinating a sort of response to stop that. Yeah. Also, but that was thousands of people, right, from all over the world who decided to try and head towards Gaza. Yeah. To break the siege. And of course, as we speak today, Zohran Mamdani has just won the NYC mayoral primary. Antoinette Latouf won in Sydney. You know, no one has yet managed to stop what's happening in Gaza. But do you feel that there is a shift happening?
Okay, let's be completely honest.
Let's
be honest. The 12 activists who sailed to Gaza, I think of them as the best of the world, as the cream of the cream. They're the best of the humanity. Millions of people have watched us being slaughtered day and night. And you know, Mariam, I always think of Gaza as this very small strip of land. 2.2 million people live in Gaza. And for the past 20 months, they've been surrounded by everywhere, and they've been bombed and starved day and night for 20 months. And even those who want to escape Gaza, there's nowhere that they can escape. Imagine living a life for 20 months where you know that you can't do anything to prevent your murder. Not even if you surrender, not even if you want to escape. There's nothing that can prevent Israel from killing you, and they're killing the Palestinians every day. Even those who go and seek food, they're being shot and killed, and the world is watching. And then after 20 months, only 12 people came out to help the Palestinian people. I think they are the best, but I'm very disappointed in the world. And I believe, Mariam, that if the world want to stop the siege in Gaza, if they want to break the siege in Gaza, they can. People have the power to stop the siege in Gaza. If one ship managed to go to Gaza, even if they did not arrive, I'm sure that 1,000 other ships can do it. And until now, we've heard some people are organizing for another 1,000 ships, but it's not happening so far. Yeah. But I know that people in Europe, in the West, in the East, everywhere, they have the power to stop the genocide in Gaza. They have the power to stop the siege, the starvation in Gaza. And unfortunately, not much has it changed. But you ask about the elections in the US, and that's a positive thing. And I believe that the way I see the world right now, I'm not very optimistic about the current situation. I'm not very optimistic for the short term. Mm-hmm. Future, But I know that in the long run, Palestine is winning. I know that Palestine is the future. And I know that what's happening in Gaza right now is motivating and inspiring the world for a change against the empire, a change against a revolution, against the establishment, the system that have that has oppressed. We in the West, we don't live in democracy. We don't live in a free, really free world. We live in a world where the few elite who has the power and authority controlling our life, our opinion, and everything. And we're just being fooled. We have been fooled for the past 70 years after World War II. And this has to change. And I think it will change because what is happening in Gaza, the genocide in Gaza, it is cultivating a new movement. A movement not only for Palestine, a movement for justice everywhere. And unfortunately, we don't have the luxury of time and waiting. We have to start now, and we have to start big. Otherwise, more and more and more people will die in Gaza. More and more and more people will die everywhere, and more people will be oppressed. And we don't have that luxury of time. So I'm happy about the future that will come, but I want it to happen faster than the pace now we're seeing.
Do you feel that people could be doing more?
Of course they can do more.
And what would you like people to see people doing more of? Because I think, you know, there's it's a very important question for people to hear answered by a Palestinian in particular, because I think a lot of people are sort of saying, well, we've tried all the formal routes, we protest, we write to our MPs, we are, you know, many people are attending multiple protests to be on the streets regularly, trying to speak up about it. Is it that people need to take more risks?
I love the protests. I often go to the protests and I speak at these protests, and I believe the protest is an amazing congregation of people who call for justice and freedom for the Palestinian people. They're very important. The protests have to continue. They have to go on. But at the same time, my message to these people who are going to these protests, if you think going to these protests is enough, that you're doing what you have to do by going to these protests, then please don't go to these protests. Because the protest is not enough, definitely is not enough. And we have been trying these protests for the past 20 months. As I said, I love the protests. Everyone should go to these protests, but they're not enough. We did not stop the genocide by participating in these protests only. So we have to scale up. We have to level up our action. And at the same time, we have to do all the action that we have to do. It has to be legal and by the law. It's very important. I don't want people to risk their life, you know, because we need people. But at the same time, I know that there is a lot of things that you can do according to the law that can stop the genocide. We have been calling for BDS for a long time. And I believe the boycott and the divestment, it's doing well, but not so many people are committing to these causes. Mm-hmm. I've been calling to boycott the BBC, mm-hmm. boycott the Sky News, mm-hmm. Protest at their doors. I want permanent occupations. Mm-hmm. We want permanent occupation of the parliament, of the foreign office, of the Downing Street. I want to see people there day and night, erecting their tents and staying there until the genocide ends. If we're not doing this, I mean, the least we can do is to do permanent occupation. The least we can do is to force the trade unions to stop funding Labour Party, which is complicit in the genocide, for example. Yeah. More and more people need to level up and scale up their action for Palestine. Because right now, if we don't make an action, I think it will be too late very, very soon. And if Israel wins in Gaza, if Israel managed to destroy Gaza and kill everyone or ethnically cleanse people in Gaza, I think there is no going back. Israel must not win in this.
You mentioned that you still have relatives in Gaza. Presumably, they are having to try and get food in the same way as everybody else is. We've seen the replacement of UNRWA, which for 70 years was responsible for delivering aid to Palestinians, well, across the region, actually. They've now been replaced by this organization, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which, you know, when they are sort of delivering the aid, we are seeing hundreds of Palestinians being killed at those sites. What do you make of the GHF, and why has it been brought in to replace UNRWA, really?
But simple. UNRWA was helping the Palestinian people. They were distributing aid and food and medication and education for the Palestinian people. And Israeli plan has always been clear from the beginning of this genocide. They want to destroy Gaza. They want to destroy everything that gives way of life to the people in Gaza. And UNRWA was giving a way of life to the people in Gaza. Israel, when you think, why would Israel bomb the hospitals? Of course Israel would bomb the hospitals, because the hospitals give way of life to the people in Gaza. They give them a treatment. So Israel don't want Palestinians to be treated. So they would bomb the hospitals. Why would they bomb the schools that are taking as shelter for the Palestinian people? Because they don't want the Palestinian people to have shelters, of course. And they bombed the bakeries in Gaza. Why would they do that? Because they don't want Palestinian people to eat. They want to make the life of the Palestinian people very, very, very hard. That the moment that Israel forced the oppressors to open, everyone would leave Gaza and live forever. And this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, it is a death trap.
Is it a branch of the genocide?
Of course it is. Of course it is. It's run by Americans and Israelis, the same people who are killing the Palestinian people. And you know, when you think about it, Israel has been claiming that UNRWA is run by Hamas, or they're anti-Semitic, and Hamas is stealing the aid. So they came up with a new way of distributing it to the people in Gaza. And we say, okay, this is the why do you even kill the people who come to receive aid and food from this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation if that is your own way of distributing food? You should encourage people to go there, not kill them. But you know what's happening? Israel killed the people who seek aid there, because Israel is not interested in giving Palestinians food the first place. They want them to starve. They want them to die. But they want to save face by pretending to the world that they have a foundation there that gives food to the people. So they're shooting Palestinians so that Palestinians don't go the other day, and to claim that they are doing their best to give food to the people in Gaza. But unfortunately, the Palestinian people don't have an option but to go there. And we think about it. Every day Israel killed 30 or 40 or 50 Palestinians there. And the other day, Palestinians would go again and again and again. And you would wonder, why would people go there if they're being killed eventually? If hundreds, thousands of people were injured? It is because they don't have any other option. Right. Because these fathers, these mothers, when they see their little kids starving to death, they would go and risk their lives, even if that means they will die. They think that even dying, even being shot and killed, is better than hearing your children scream for food. And they do it over and over and over again. And unfortunately, Maryam, the world is watching.
And accepting the smoke and mirrors, right? Because we're sort of discussing it in legacy media as if this is actually part of an aid effort, as opposed to part of the wider genocidal project. And I think that's something that I'm really curious to hear your view on, because I know you've obviously taken issues with a lot of the way in which the reporting on Gaza has been undertaken. You mentioned the BBC, you mentioned Sky, but I'm sure you could point the finger beyond them as well. You know, is there a problem in how the GHF is even being described in legacy media currently?
The only way to describe the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is as a death trap, as a tool of the genocidal Israeli state that's being used to kill the Palestinians and starve them and humiliate the Palestinian people. If you're not reporting that in this way, then you are aiding and abetting the genocide. Then you're encouraging the genocide. There's no other way to put it in words.
Right, by affording them otherwise legitimacy in terms of what they purport to be doing versus what's actually happening on the ground. You mentioned these criminal gangs, and of course the internet is full of content claiming that Hamas is stealing aid. But Netanyahu has acknowledged backing criminal groups, including ISIS-affiliated gangs, arming them to allegedly push back Hamas because, I quote Netanyahu here, any harm to the Hamas regime serves us. Is there a sort of engineered social collapse being undertaken here? Why is Netanyahu arming these gangs?
He has always been arming these gangs. You know, and I remember at the beginning of the genocide, Israel and the Israeli propagandists would always say Hamas, ISIS, ISIS, Hamas, claiming that Hamas and ISIS are the same thing, and that the Palestinian people supported Hamas and voted for Hamas, then the Palestinian people are ISIS. But now it's clear who is ISIS and who is supporting ISIS and who is really giving ISIS a protection and money and weapons and the trucks, the same Netanyahu trucks that went into Israel in the 7th of October. Now Israel is giving these ISIS groups the same kind of attracts. So now we would wonder why would Israel support ISIS and give them weapons?
What do you mean by that?
Israel always loved ISIS. Israel was treating ISIS fighters in Syria who were injured, and we all know that. And Israel loves ISIS, and Israel loves when Palestinians are too extremists, because they want to portray all the Palestinians as these terrorists and extremists. But at the same time, in real time, these people are not even religious. This ISIS group in Gaza, they're not even religious. They're not even claiming to be good Muslims who are protecting Islam as ISIS would usually do. They are drug dealers. And they have been imprisoned by Hamas because they were drug dealers, because they were caught having a huge amount of drugs and they were distributing to Gaza. And they have always been supported by Israel. Israel is engineering this social collapse. They have been known for a very long time to be supporting drug dealers in Gaza, giving them drugs so that they destroy the Palestinian people. They have been supported with weapons to make like this Palestinian rift and clashes among the Palestinians. And now during the genocide, from the very beginning, they have been instructing their collaborators and ISIS, Israeli-backed ISIS, to go to these humanitarian convoys to steal it and to destroy it. Why? Because they want the Palestinians to starve. Because they want the Palestinians to be angry. Because they want Palestinians to fight with each other.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I still feel that this sort of the Hasbara, the spin, the kind of Israeli attempts to kind of constantly control the narrative around what's happening is still working to some extent, because we continue to see sort of a legacy media obsession with Hamas. You know, despite the fact that we know that in many ways Israel facilitated Hamas rule by allowing the entry of funds to them during their time of rule. And we also know that that was kind of an attempt to weaken the PLO. We also know that Hamas has offered to step down in the last month or so in favor of a technocratic government in exchange for a ceasefire. That hardly made the news, and Israel clearly did not accept that. So if Hamas has agreed to step down, and the Israelis claim that this is all about Hamas and Hamas no longer being in control, why don't we have a ceasefire, Ahmed?
Because simply Israel does not want a ceasefire. And Israel, maybe I can dare to say that Israel does not want to see the total collapse of Hamas, by the way. Israel, Netanyahu was very insistent that he wants to support Hamas by the Qatari money that goes to Gaza. They wanted to see that, you know, because they want to keep the Palestinians separated from each other, West Bank and Gaza. And even in the 70s, by the way, they were trying to support Hamas to overcome the PFLP. That was the Israeli way. I'm not saying that Hamas is a direct product of Israel and Israel loves Hamas or Hamas loves Israel. Of course not. That's not the case. But Israel always wanted to encourage the separation between the Palestinian factions from the Palestinian people, because that serves the Israeli interest, definitely. And that's very unfortunate. So why is Israel doing this? Because Israel does not want a ceasefire. Israel does not want to see a total collapse of Hamas. Israel does not want their hostages back. And it's not a claim, it's a reality. Netanyahu does not want his hostages back. Netanyahu was killing his own hostages. Netanyahu was killing his own people on the 7th of October by the Hannibal Directive. That is not me, a Palestinian, trying to like throw some claims here or there. This is facts. Israel wants a ceasefire only when there are no Palestinians in Gaza at all, when all of Gaza is completely destroyed. Israel thinks of this war or this genocide as an opportunity, you know, an opportunity to get rid of the Palestinians, all the Palestinians in Gaza, for now in Gaza, and then we'll go to the West Bank. And I don't think Israel will want to end the war, the genocide, before that objective is completed.
We know that there have been some of the largest land grabs in the West Bank over the course of the last 20 months. You know, it's been a real opportunity whilst eyes were on Gaza to grab even more territory within the West Bank. And now there's news of a tunnel being built, basically connecting the West Bank to Jerusalem, which I think would essentially ensure that all Palestinians between Jericho and Jerusalem would essentially be, you know, ethnically cleansed. And it would also make the, as you say, the connection between these populations a lot more tenuous. And so simultaneously, and it sort of feels like a pattern, tell me, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but it feels like almost like a pattern where every time there's a talk of some sort of a Palestinian state, which we've seen a number of European leaders calling for, that discussion is happening simultaneously to the geographical erasure of any potential Palestinian state. And so I'm curious to hear what you make of these calls that we're hearing now increasingly for the recognition of a Palestinian state, or the more recent EU-backed initiative to discuss a two-state solution, when the reality that we see on the ground is of a very fast pace, an increasingly fast pace, physical disintegration of that, even as a geographical entity.
Well, in Israel now we see fascism is on the rise. Now we see ministers in the Israeli government who are complete fanatics, fascists, whose own purpose of life and joining politics is to grab lands and to annex the West Bank. Now, if you study the Israeli psyche, they're very interested in the West Bank. The West Bank for them is very, very important because they have this kind of, I don't know,
the Judea and Samaria idea.
And for them, the West Bank is way more important than Gaza. So it has always been very clear that Israel wants to annex the West Bank and all of the West Bank. And even at the peace talks after Oslo, the settlements did not stop. They have always been consistent. They have always been building new settlements. They have always been swallowing more Palestinian lands in the West Bank. Yes, there are some states who are recognizing Palestine in Europe, but I believe that is only just to save face. Like, they want to pretend that they're doing something for Palestine after they have watched the genocide. But I don't think that can actually change the facts on the ground. Israel is determined to annex the West Bank, all of the West Bank, and to ethnically cleanse the people in Gaza. And the more states recognize the state of Palestine, the more Israel will take more lands. And in the middle of the genocide, everyone will be focused on the genocide in Gaza, and they will forget that there is an active plan of ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, active plan of annexation, and it will continue. And I believe if people really want to help Palestine, these European countries, they should do something more effective than just this, recognizing the state of Palestine.
I wonder what you make of the argument I've heard floated in some spaces that actually the push to restart this idea of a two-state solution is less actually about preserving Palestine and maybe actually about preserving Israel at a time where its existence has never been more contested among younger audiences in particular.
I actually lean towards this idea, to be honest. I don't want to really underestimate what people are trying to do for Palestine or the steps by the states and what they do for Palestine. If the other states want to tell the Palestinian people that they stand with the Palestinian people, that they really oppose the genocide, then there are more effective ways to show their solidarity and their support for Palestine. Like, for example, enforce an arms embargo on Israel. How is it that you recognize the state of Palestine and you still complicit in supporting arms to Israel? How is it that you see a country that is committing a genocide against their own people and you still have their ambassadors in your country? Mm-hmm. You still have normal relations with Israel. How is it that you still do trades with Israel? That all doesn't make sense. I'm not very occupied with the idea of one-state solution or two-state solution. I just want a solution that would protect the Palestinian people. But we all know that the two-state solution is really dead. And if people want to really enforce a two-state solution, it should be in more meaningful way than just recognizing a Palestinian state that does not have any borders, that does not have any sovereignty, that does not have any freedom, and it lives under the boots of the Israeli occupation.
We need more than symbolic gestures, I'm hearing at this point.
Exactly, more than symbolic gestures.
In your book, Ahmed, you talk about your older brother. There's a really moving story. It's actually the first story in the book that's about your older brother, Ayman, God rest his soul. He was killed as a resistance fighter by an Israeli airstrike in the 2014 assault on Gaza. And you've said in past interviews very clearly that you would never have made the same choices as Ayman. So I want to ask you, what does resistance mean to you personally?
Well, resistance is a very broad concept. When we say resistance, we don't necessarily mean the armed resistance in which people go and attack Israeli soldiers or violent resistance. Resistance comes in many, many, many shapes, many, many, many forms. One of them is writing. Writing is, I think, one of the most important forms of resistance. Journalism is one of the most important forms of resistance. Telling the Palestinian stories, art, sharing the culture of the Palestinian people, and also resilient on the Palestinian lands is a form of resistance. All of these are forms of resistance, and we Palestinians we should protect our right of resistance.
Do you think that when you are, because I've seen you interviewed on a number of different shows where, despite kind of acknowledging that you'd lost 21 members of your family and more, I'm sure, injured and still going through the genocide, the question of being asked to condemn Hamas comes up again and again and again in these interviews. When you are asked, do you condemn Hamas, Ahmed, what is really being asked?
They want any statement from a Palestinian who lost his family that would justify the murder and the genocide of the Palestinian people. And I don't have a problem with condemning Hamas or Hamas acts. It's not that I'm good friends with Hamas. I don't have a problem with that. But when I'm asked in a hostile environment to condemn Hamas, this is like, okay, this is a Palestinian person who's giving Israel the justification to kill the people in Gaza and to do the genocide in Gaza. If I were ever asked to condemn Hamas or think or talk about what I think of Hamas, I don't have a problem with that. But if I am in a neutral environment or if I am in a friendly environment. But unfortunately, now we Palestinians, we view the mainstream media or these journalists as people who are serving in the Israeli army in a way or another. And I do not want to support the Israeli army in any way possible. I do not want to help the genocide against my people. And that's why I always refuse to answer this question.
In the West, there's a focus on nonviolent resistance as being a sort of morally superior way to gain your freedom. And I'm sure that's got nothing to do with the fact that most of the time, the movements in question are fighting against Western forces or Western forms of occupation or colonization. Sure, it's not to do with that at all. But you've talked about storytelling as a really important form of resistance. How effective has nonviolent resistance proven for Palestinians?
You know, Mariam, in many times when I was watching movies, historic movies, they would always tell you that those who were resisting oppression and occupation and colonization throughout history, throughout time, were the good people. Even when you use the armed resistance against the oppression, you would always be described as a good person, as someone who is a freedom fighter. Freedom fighters were there everywhere, all through time, all through history. The Italians resisted the occupation at some time. And this song, Bella Ciao, it was about like commending the people who are freedom fighting. And in Algeria, in South Africa, in everywhere.
Even in my country, in France, we celebrate the resistance fighters.
Of course, it has always been, normal people would always view that those who are resisting the occupation, those who are resisting oppression, those who are fighting back against genocide and colonization and settler colonial regimes, throughout history, throughout time, they have always been described as freedom fighters. But when it comes to Palestine, everyone is so scared to talk about resistance. As if you resist the occupation, that is Israel, then you are a terrorist. And that is really wrong. I mean, let me say it in a more clear way. If you are someone who calls yourself a pro-Palestine and you think that the Palestinian people do not deserve to have the right of armed resistance, then we do not need your solidarity and support. Go away. We don't need you. We, the Palestinian people, we are a people. We are humans. And we deserve every right as everyone else. And we are a people who abide by the laws, by the international law. And the international law says people who live under occupation, and Palestine is known to be a country that lives under occupation.
It's internationally recognized as being under occupation.
Yeah, we are called the occupied Palestinian territories here in the UK and the US everywhere. And if you think that the Palestinian, and according to the international law, we have the right to resist the occupation by all means possible. I am someone who believes in the, I believe that the Palestinian people have the right to resist the occupation with arms. But I don't believe that this way is very helpful to the Palestinian people.
Well, this is the big debate, right?
Which this is the big
particularly
debate.
About the effectiveness, given the impact on your relatives, your friends, people that you've left behind in Gaza today, who are living through the consequences, right, of the choices of armed resistance. But I want to put this quote, if I may, yes. to you from the Palestinian writer and activist Mohammed El-Kurz, who's yes. recently written a book around this notion of perfect victims. He says, "If I stood and read a poem before the Qalandia military barrier, it wouldn't crumble and catch fire." That's a checkpoint for people, obviously, who are not aware of Qalandia. Then he asked, "What is the role of literature? Who does it serve here in the English-speaking world, in fancy hotel lobbies and Ivy League auditoriums, planets away from the makeshift rifles of the refugee camps? It's hard to say. It's hard to imagine what a poem can do in the barrel of a gun."
That's very powerful.
Yeah, I'm someone who's always, like you, believed in the power of storytelling. And I have to say that the last 20 months have challenged my personal beliefs around this area. I still believe in the power of stories. I'm part of why I do what I do. But I'm definitely shaken in a profound way about the extent to which, you know, people like yourself and people even, you know, in Gaza would be asked to use methods that are often inaudible to Western audiences. What would you say in response to Mohammed El-Kurd's
statement? Well, I think Mohammed El-Kurd is a giant. He's amazing, and he's the best writer I know. And he's a friend of mine. I love him so much. He's amazing. And what he's talking about is very reasonable. It's very realistic. I mean, it's right now, if you live in Gaza under this genocide and tell the people in Gaza, writing is a form of resistance, they would laugh at you. They would tell you, what are you talking about? Do you think if I read a poem to the Israeli F-16, it will stop bombing me? Of course not. Of course, right now we are in a position where writing and all of it's not going to stop the genocide, especially as we're dealing with this genocidal maniac army that is intent to killing all the Palestinian people and every one of the Palestinian people, especially the young people, by the way, because they think of them as future terrorists, as they think. Yeah, but I don't disagree with Muhammad. Muhammad has all the right to say and to write whatever he wants. And I love his book, Perfect Victims. But one thing I want to say, I'm not saying that there is one form of resistance that we have to adopt and go forward with it. I would never pretend to believe that writing is the only meaningful and effective way of resisting the occupation. That is bullshit. I'm sorry.
I want to put another statement by another giant, intellectual giant here, from the African-American civil rights movement. Assata Shakur once said that nobody in history has ever gotten their freedom by appealing to the moral sense of the people who were oppressing them. Whether that is, as we've just mentioned, the Black civil rights movement in the US, South African apartheid, Ireland, in all these struggles, we have a dominant resistance embodied by the people, typically often actually nonviolent. Just the fact of existing as a Palestinian or as a person under occupation is resistance, as we know. But there is typically also a militarized wing who keep pressure to ensure that the occupiers or the colonizers have to come to the negotiating table. What do you say to this idea?
I love this conversation with you, Maria.
Thank you, Ahmed.
Well, here's the thing. Anyone who claims that appealing to Israel will give you a right back is an idiot. Appealing to Israel, to the oppressor, will never give you any rights. These people do not see you as a human being to begin with. They see you as an animal who just needs to be destroyed and ethnically cleansed from Gaza. But when we talk about the peaceful resistance, we're not talking about appealing to the oppressor. We're talking about using every means, every pressure against occupation.
I was walking through South Bank the other day and I saw a big bust of Nelson Mandela, hero of the anti-apartheid movement. Do you think one day we'll see the bust of a Palestinian leader in central London representing what I'm sure by then will be a very whitewashed version of the Palestinian liberation struggle?
100%. I see it happening. It will happen. Now, the majority of people here in the UK, they support justice and freedom for the Palestinian people. And every day, things change, and it will change. And they see it will happen.
Mm.
But the question is when.
Yeah.
Not whether it will happen or not, but when. And I really want it to happen right now. I don't want to wait. Because the more time we wait, the more Palestinians will die.
Right. And at the moment, what do you make of this move to seemingly isolate Netanyahu and Ben-Gavir from the wider picture of Israeli accountability? I'm sure you've noticed
this. It is an attempt to save Israel. Because the problem is not Netanyahu. Only an idiot would think that the problem in Israel is Netanyahu. The problem is all of the system in Israel and all of the system that is behind Israel. The system that sees different people better than others, more people, different people, more superior than others. People who back Israel and people who support Israel from within. All of that system is flawed, is problematic. And now, because everyone is seeing that the ship is sinking, they want to make it, it's only Netanyahu's problem. So tomorrow we will replace Netanyahu and Israel will be an amazing safe haven for everyone. No, this is not going to happen. You'll have to crush the apartheid in Israel. You have to destroy that system. If you don't, then the problem will persist. And I have to tell you, those who killed my family, the 14 kids in my family, it was not Netanyahu who pulled the trigger. It was a chain of personnel, leaders and pilots and militants who took the decision to kill my family. Netanyahu did not pull the trigger when they kill hundreds of Palestinians who are seeking aid and the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation distribution centers. It was soldiers on the ground. And all of that system is flawed. It's problematic. It's racist. It's dangerous. And it has to be stopped. It has to be brought to a halt. The problem is not only Netanyahu. Netanyahu is only the face of the problem. And saving Israel will require to sacrifice Netanyahu to put another face of it. And I don't accept that.
For a long time, the Palestinian cause has been a central issue in the Arab public imagination, right? It's been one of the most unifying causes, I would argue, amongst the Arab and Muslim world. But when we look at Gaza today and even what's happening in the West Bank, what's happening in Palestine across the board, we see isolation, right? You mentioned this earlier on. We've seen several Latin American countries, Brazil, Bolivia, Chile, Colombia, who have publicly recalled ambassadors to Israel or downgraded their ties, but not a single Arab state has done so. What do you make of that?
I know that the Arab people, all of them, their hearts are with the Palestinian people. Listen, I've been to Egypt. The Egyptian people are the nicest people ever. I love the Egyptian people. And I've been in many different other countries and they all love Palestine. I know where the hearts of the Arabs are. They are with the Palestinian people and they hate the oppression and they hate the occupation as much as we Palestinians do. But I'm just disappointed that the least that the governments can do is to end their normalization with Israel, to cut their diplomatic ties with Israel. And I understand that they can't go militarily and save Gaza. I know they can't, but at least show us that you care about us. Because right now I'm disappointed.
So according to Dr. Imad Kahab, the Director of Research and Analysis at the Arab Center in Washington, the abandonment of the Palestinians is directly related to the Arab governments becoming more authoritarian and their continuing political and economic dependence on the United States. Do you see a connection between this sort of reworking of the region over the last few decades, where we have seen, post-independence in the Middle East from the 1960s onwards, the emergence of, essentially Western-backed dictatorships across much of the region? And the extent to which that is now decoupling national liberation struggles, you know, people's attempts to kind of survive under authoritarianism from the wider Arab liberation movement, of which I think Palestine was often seen as the front line.
I just wish that the Arabs, the Arabic regimes, really see Israel for what it really is. And it's not just a matter about Palestine or the Palestinian liberation. It is about them as well. When Israel is done with the Palestinians, they will come for the Arabs. They will come for Egypt. They will come for Jordan. They will come for Syria. They will come for Lebanon. They have come for Syria and Lebanon. But they will come even more. Is the Israeli ideology, the Zionist ideology, is not that they're content and settled with what they have. They have expansionist colonial ideology, and they want to expand and expand and expand. And Israel, they will never rest until all the Arab regimes, all the Arab countries are not settled. It is not in Israel's interest that they have powerful, strong, independent economies with the Arabs. They will always want to destroy the Arab countries. They will always want to destroy the Arab stability. And after they're done with Gaza, they will come to everyone. So I really encourage them to wake up, because they're not helping their people. They're not even helping themselves by standing by. And unfortunately, the Arabs are now standing by. They're not doing any meaningful thing to stop the genocide. They're not doing any meaningful steps to stop Israel. Mm. So I want them to wake up.
Final question to you, Ahmed. There'll be people who are watching this who will be wanting to take their cue from you on what more they can be doing. They're here in this country, they're protesting, they're writing to their MPs, they are trying to boycott. You know, what more would you call on people to be doing at this time, given what you've urgently laid out in terms of this is not abstract, this is not happening in the future, this is happening right now?
Do you know what I want people to do? I want them to close their eyes and imagine for a moment that what's happening in Gaza right now is happening to them, that they were in the shoes of the Palestinian people, that the starvation is their starvation, that the children who are being killed and starved in Gaza are their own. I want them to imagine that for the past 20 months, they have been living surrounded by everywhere, and they're being bombed day and night. That for the past 7 years, they have been deprived of their freedom, of their sovereignty, that they are living under brutal, brutal military occupation. That for the past 18 years, they have been living under brutal siege and blockade. I want them to imagine, if they were in that position, what would they want other people who are watching them to do? And then do what comes to your mind.
Ahmed, thank you so much for sharing your story and bring this incredible book to the world.
Thank you very much for having me, Maryam.
Thank you, Ahmed.
You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio. I want to take a moment to highlight an urgent call to action that demands our attention. Every Tuesday, from 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock p.m., community members gather for the Stand Out to Stop the Killing outside the Zionist Consulate at 20 Park Plaza in Boston. This is more than a protest. It's a stand for humanity, for accountability, and for the lives being lost in silence. Your presence matters. Show up, speak out, and stand for justice. That's all for today's episode. Stay informed, stay engaged, and never stop asking the hard questions. Until next time, I'm your host, Reynat Al Ghul, and you've been listening to This Week in Palestine. If you have any questions, thoughts, or would like to support our work, feel free to reach out at twippodcasts@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. A heartfelt thank you to you, our listeners, and to the incredible team working behind the scenes to bring this show to life. Deep gratitude to Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Lish, Tahani Abu Mosa, Dr. Bethany Marks, Dr. Rana Awad, Professor Ann Lucas, Juliette Salama Olivier, and Mohammed Al Ghul. Your dedication and passion make this possible. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, proudly broadcasting from WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, thank you for spending your time with us as we continue the journey toward Palestinian liberation. We'll see you next week.
Everything was quiet, then came the sound. My teddy bear fell as I looked around. Where did Mama go? She was just right here. And Papa's voice I strained to hear. So dark in here. Where did all the light go? Can anyone hear me? I just wanna know. La la la. Oh. Strange faces gather, they're taking me. My small voice trembles, I beg them to stay. Please find my sister, she's just a baby still, but no one else.